tune consciousness, words, mantras, vibrations that initiate neurological procedures. I treat the experience of going on stage, performing, as sacred. The origin of theatre is in religion. There is a shamanism in performance. Don't get me wrong, there doesn't have to be. You can get up on stage in front of thousands of people and confirm things they already know, if you like, but it is an opportunity to bring down information from other realms to induce a collective state. That's a bit fucking grandiose, ain't it? Are you bringing down information from other realms when you're talking about your willy at the Hammersmith Apollo? Were you trying to induce a transcendent state of consciousness when you left that message on Andrew Sachs's answer phone? Good point. There are definitely flaws in my nature and mistakes have been made, but I have observed that the more I have engaged with the transcendent, the more I've explored practices that are designed to alleviate the burden of materialism and individualism, the greater access I have to a feeling of serenity and freedom, the more I enjoy my work, the more I feel free. I think these techniques will work for anyone. I believe the techniques I've been taught to live drug-free, the methods I've used to improve my work and relationships, will work for anyone who uses them and will release anyone from any behaviour that impedes happiness. Not just obvious stuff like drug addiction, less obvious stuff like food addiction, spending addiction, or caring too much what other people think of you addiction. The stuff I learned in order to make me better at my job has taught me that my job doesn't matter, that no individual job matters when compared to our common good. When we as individuals collectively access this frequency, we will realise that we have a shared destiny and that we can design a fair and rational system that does what it's supposed to do, enhances the whole and respects the individual. Wu Wei, Slingerland explained, is usually accessed when in a state of relaxed concentration in pursuit of a higher purpose. That doesn't have to mean building an orphanage. I think the focus required to succeed in a penalty shootout is still an applicable example. When attuned to the objectives of the team and the supporters, an objective that transcends self, unencumbered by meddlesome individualistic concerns, you can achieve flow. When reflecting on the power that can be accessed by getting beyond the self in the moment, it becomes apparent how prohibitive the concept of self is. We are subject to a mass hypnosis and believe that our individual needs are more important and in conflict with our collective needs. My friend Gareth has just returned from the 2014 FA Cup final. He is a fan of defeated finalists Hull City FC. In spite of the extra time defeat, he talks excitedly of how fulfilling the experience was. What he is describing is how social codes and rituals can be used to create an identity that supersedes the concept of self with which we habitually connect. Who are you really? Are you your name? The place you are from? The negative feelings you had as a child, the anxieties you have about your future? No, these are all conceptual. In this moment now, your name is not real, your relationships are irrelevant, and most importantly, your thoughts, all your thoughts, are secondary. In my mind, even as I talk and adhere to the metaphorical codes of language, there is another awareness, a distinct awareness, an awareness beyond, behind, and around those incessant thoughts. While some other inaccessible aspect of my being keeps my heart pumping, produces digestive enzymes, makes the muscles in my fingers spasm according to the precise QWERTY ballet, there is awareness. This awareness is often neglected in favour of fear and regret or projected need. If you are in Wembley Stadium, though, and Hull have just gone 2-0 up against favourites Arsenal, and all about you are thousands of people dressed in yellow and black, the same as you, singing the same songs as you, craving the same outcome as you, there is a synchronicity that takes you out of the self. Where else do we get to cry and pray and laugh and sing in communion these days? Where else do we receive the affirmation that we are connected to one another, that we're not born alone to die alone? In front of our TVs? Staring obediently at the glare of a smartphone, infuriated in traffic in an aluminium cell. We are imprisoned within, hypnotized without, denying ourselves access to the internal peace and external harmony. Can we execute the perfect jailbreak when we have become our own jailers? Chapter 5. Is everybody in? Once, by chance, whilst in a church basement with other members of an abstinence-based recovery community, I heard, coming through the grate, an almighty wail from the main church hall, a sound beyond language, both intriguing and disturbing. I regularly keep the company of other recovering drunks and addicts, as I learn a lot from those with more clean time than me, and more still from those with less. People with more time tell me how they continue to cope with an external world that will not submit to their imagined demands and an ego that is defined by its insatiability, this restless demon that forever wants more, that lingers like a tapeworm at the gateway to the soul, devouring and rejecting according to its needs. From those that stagger in with fumes on their breath, stains on their teeth and fear in their eyes, I learn the most important lesson, gratitude. Whatever I endure in recovery, I need never again suffer the indignity of active addiction, the despair and hopelessness, the inexhaustible cycle of incremental self-immolation. I am reminded of how far I've come, of the miracle that with help and humility I can one day at a time live free from drugs and alcohol. Today, though, the racket from the vent enchants me. This perversely seductive din is in need of investigation, so I quietly slip out the back, though I could have clanged out in metal wellies with this crescendoing hullabaloo unabating in the next room. There's no interior door that leads me to the source of the siren, so I wander round the Kensal Green Church, a typical church in West London, St Martin's or St Something, a few hundred years old or whatever, on a corner in the early evening. As I circumnavigate the unremarkable perimeter, the alien choir grows louder, and I'm pretty certain I've found the right door, so I give it an assertive shove, but it's locked. I strain to reach a tiptoed meerkat peer up to the window, high like an apple in a fable. I can't see nothing, so I do a first knock. The first knock, always quiet, the split intention of getting attention without causing a disturbance. The second knock, a little more committal. The third, almost an attempt to split the wood, is the one they hear, the only one they heard, the one I might as well have done in the first place. If you're going to knock, knock. Within, there is a sparse congregation, surprisingly small, given the discordant requiem of caterwauling. Of the 30 parishioners, all eyes face the front, but for a girl aged about 9 at the back with a book at a doll's house desk, all little, like when you go back to your old school. I try not to look meek, although I wouldn't mind inheriting the earth when I walk in. I try to seem, in spite of appearances, like I should be there. At this point, though, it doesn't matter, because the only person looking is the little girl, and she is super friendly and smiles. The adults, the everybody else, are looking to the front, well, facing the front, because most of their eyes are closed, or rolled back in their heads, or facing down at their feet as they sway and incant. At the front, there are 3 men. I reckon African. I reckon everyone is African in the room. I mean, not everyone, although if humans all came from Africa originally, then I suppose we all are. If humanity, instead of an object, is an event, then we are. If you watched in fast-frame photography like a fungus or a flower opening and shutting with the sped-up movement of the sun, if you removed the concept of time that applies only to our linear lives, then humanity just sprang up and spread and grew and conquered, then turned in on itself. Then what? I suppose that's where we are now. Not this lot, though, in Kensal Green. This 30 or so humans are entranced in some dance. The main man is a shoeless, bearded bloke. His hair and beard are grey, so his face looks like it's pushing through a storm cloud or dirty bubble bath, or like when Lenny Henry used to do David Bellamy. He is speaking in tongues, loudly. The fellas that are with him are too, up there at the front of this modest church hall, unadorned with wooden rows or pulpits or stained glass, much more a place where scouts would meet up or scones would be sold than a spirit summoned. There's another bloke at the side playing a keyboard, but you can only hear it intermittently because of the other, far weightier tunes, unidentifiable lyrics, except once in a while I hear Jesus, like a twig floating by in a stream of babble. Everyone looks poor. The women are mostly seated, occasionally escorted to the front by the equivalent of an altar boy or verger. Once there, the main man, the bearded preacher, bridles and jabs and spasms and gurns like a pre-ejaculatory James Brown. The younger ones, a fellow with a shaved head and an orange polo shirt like a cashier at Halfords might wear, and a bloke who is in my head, already been replaced by Carlton from the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, swoop round each new arrival to the stage area, though let me stress it is not a stage, not raised, distinguished only in that it is nominally the front. Intermittently, when a space becomes vacant, the assistants stray into the congregation to recruit another participant. The candidates are seemingly selected on the basis of eye contact, then ushered to the front. There is a pull-down screen with a projection of, I assume, a biblical text, again in an unrecognisable language, again but for the appearance here and there of Jesus. It looks to me to be a patriarchy. The men are dominant. I stand at the back, not knowing quite where to put my hands. I try clasped at the back like a royal being shown round a former colonial village, then at the front like a footballer in a wall awaiting a free kick. The little girl, who seems to be the only person there taking any managerial responsibility, sweetly offers me a chair. I tell her I'm okay. Me and her are the only ones not in some degree of reverie. Bellamy, Orange Shirt and Carlton are screaming their heads off. A tall, really tall man with a shaved head in a long, really long suit is having a wild time up there and has none of my self-doubt in where to position his hands. They are thrust heavenwards, taut like a Nazi for whom one Sieg Heil is just not enough, a double-barrelled Nazi. The women sway and jump and shriek. Whilst this is all almost entirely foreign, there is something familiar, like a place in your mouth where food always gets caught. Something I recognise. It is orgiastic. This Christianity with a voodoo twist is on the brink of Dionysian breakdown. Through this ritual, I see the root of ritual, the exorcising of the primal, the men engorged, enraged, the women serpentine and lithe, only the child excluded. I get on my knees, which a few other people are doing out of respect, but also because I'm beginning to sense that it's only a matter of time before I'm ushered to the front. I've not been taught how to be religious. Religious studies at school doesn't even begin to cover it. There, the world's greatest faiths and the universe's swirling mysteries are recited like bus timetables. No teacher of RE ever said to me, beyond the limited realm of the senses, the shallow pool of the known, is a great untamable ocean and we don't have a fucking clue what goes on in there. What we receive through sight, sound, smell, taste and touch is all we know. We have tools that can enhance that information. We have theories for things that we suspect lie beyond that information, filtered through apparatus, limited once more to the senses. Those senses are limited. The light range we detect is within a narrow spectrum between infrared light and ultraviolet light. Other species see light we can't see. In the auditory realm, we hear but a fraction of the sound vibrations. We don't hear high-pitched frequencies like dog whistles. We don't hear low frequencies like whale song. The world is awash with colours unseen and abuzz with unheard frequencies, undetected and disregarded. The wise have always known that these inaccessible realms, these dimensions that cannot be breached by our beautifully blunt senses, hold the very codes to our existence. The invisible electromagnetic foundations upon which our gross reality clumsily rests. Expressible only through symbol and stories, it can never be known by the innocent mind. The stories are formulas, poems, tools for reflection through which we may access the realm behind the thinking mind, the consciousness behind knowing and known, the awareness that is not connected to the haphazard data of biography, the awareness that is not prickled and tugged by capricious emotion, the awareness that is aware that it is aware. In meditation, I access it. In yoga, I feel it. On drugs, it hit me like a hammer. At 16, staring into a bathroom mirror on LSD, contrary to instruction, don't look in the mirror, Russ, it'll fuck your head up. Mental note, look in mirror. I saw that my face wasn't my face at all, but a face that I lived behind and was welded to by a billion nerves. I looked into my eyes and saw there was something looking back at me that was not me, not what I'd taken to be me. The unrefined ocean beyond the shallow pool was cascading through the mirror back at me. Nature looking at nature. Not me, little old Russ, tossed about on turbulent seas. These distinctions were engineered. On acid, these realizations are absolute. The disobedient brain is whipped into its basket like a yapping hound cowed by Caesar Milan. When meditating, it is initially more tenuous. Let me explain it this way. You know that bloke who tightrope walks between skyscrapers? No? You want his name? Google it yourself. His great triumph was a walk between the twin towers of the World Trade Center. I don't know the exact date, except it was sometime before September the 11th, 2001. He walks across a thick metal cable strung between the two buildings. Obviously, this requires great training and presence of mind, and, might I suggest, a touch of ooh-way. Last thing you want when suspended a mile above Manhattan in little ballet slippers is some taunting recorded voice from your childhood telling you you're a cunt. More than the incredible bravery of the man and his tenacity and focus, I was interested in how they attached the rope between the two buildings. A helicopter? An elevator? How do you get a metal cable that probably weighs a ton across a 200-foot gap a quarter of a mile in the sky? What they did was attach a thin piece of very light fishing thread to an arrow, then they shot the arrow between the two buildings. The thin thread was attached, and then wires, strings, ropes and cables of gradually increasing thickness were pulled across. It is with increments of this nature that mantra meditation induces a different state of consciousness. At first, when you close your eyes, the mantra is like a thin thread continually interrupted by other thoughts. A mantra is just a word, a thought vibration, repeated in the mind. At some point in the past, the mind has, for some reason, taken on the duty of trying to solve every single problem you are having, have had, or might have in the future, which makes it a frenetic and restless device. There is always something for it to think, always something for it to solve. So whenever I first start to meditate, the mantra is a tiny clear droplet lost in a deluge of sludge. I'm not a person who finds meditation a doddle or to whom yoga comes naturally. To tell you the truth, I find the whole business a bit poncy and contrary to the way I used to see myself. It's only the fact that I decimated my life by aggressively pursuing the models of living that were most immediately available, eating, wanking, drinking, consuming, getting famous, that I was forced to look at alternatives. Alternatives that you could call spiritual. I'm not a total idiot. If taking drugs worked, I'd still be doing it. If promiscuous sex was continually fulfilling, I'd have carried on. If fame and money were the answer, I'd hurl this microphone out of the window and get on with making movies. They don't work, in spite of what I was told. And there's a reason for that we'll discover. I don't see myself as a yoga person or a man who meditates and prays and eats well and says namaste or God bless you. I became that because I exhausted all other options. There was a point, I'll admit, when I flung myself full force into an LA New Age lifestyle. I just got divorced and a movie I wanted to do well didn't meet my expectations. My response to this was to stop shaving and start wearing pyjamas outdoors. This is relatively typical behaviour for any lunatic. We see them everywhere, twitching, twisting, hollering at their imagined foes. The difference is, I was doing it in Hollywood and my pyjamas looked suitably ethnic, so I think I got away with it. Although my mates have subsequently told me they were worried, and thinking about it, they did drop hints like, trim your beard, you look like a shoe bomber, and stop wearing them gap year trousers, you fucking nut. But I was immune. A friend of mine, himself no stranger to mental illness, and that's putting it lightly, he's a right fucking fruitcake, living at his mum's on disability benefits, said to me, in India, if you have a mental breakdown, they don't build you back up again. They leave you in communion with God. He then looked up, mimicking, I suppose, an Indian yogi, and raised his hands and eyes skywards as if he were playing a tiny accordion just in front of his hairline. They say, ah, he's in conversation with Brahman now, and they revere you. In this country, they just give you a bus pass. He carried on, waving his hands and flickering his eyes. Yet you've demonstrated that for too long now, mate, I said. We were in company. I'm not demonstrating it, he said. I'm doing it. He does have a free bus pass. In a way, I suppose what he meant was that when you redact the conventional behaviours and beliefs of your culture, you're regarded as a nutter. But who are you, stripped of those things that tell you who you are? Your job, your car, your husband, your kids, your favourite TV show, that pasta dish you do that's just so all these things that will one day go with death if not before. With death if not before. Good to find out who you are with nothing, because nothing is really what we have. During this pyjama time, I was doing a lot of meditation and a lot of yoga, kundalini yoga. Kundalini yoga is the crack cocaine of yoga. If hatha is a mild weed high, iyengar is a deep hash glow, and ashtanga is amphetamine, kundalini blows the fucking doors off. Technically, it is distinctive because of its use of breath of fire. This is a rapid, rhythmic, usually nasal inhalation-exhalation that you motivate from the abdomen. This is accompanied by mantras and movements and definitely changes the way you feel. A cynical person might call this change wooziness brought on by hyperventilation, but I think that's reductive. What is the alteration in consciousness that occurs during inadvertent hyperventilation? There are several yoga positions that induce in me, a state of awareness that is cracked open with sudden abundance, like the filters and commentary are suddenly flipped off. I don't, in these scarce and beautiful moments, have a conventional sense of self. I don't know my name, I don't know what I want or what I'm afraid of. All that data is wiped, and I fucking like it. An hour of these kundalini exercises in the correct sequence can induce some interesting states of consciousness. Most yogas relax or invigorate. If you do hatha yoga, your mental focus on breath and movement reduces the torrent of egoic thinking and designates the mind in the present, which, let's face it, is where it belongs. No point leaving the mind loitering around last Tuesday, especially if something bad happened. Ashtanga is more aerobic. And through the repeated movement and the strict relationship between breath and asana, or position, a vital elation can be experienced. My understanding of most yoga is that the exercises connect mind, body and spirit, and in so doing, alleviate the suffering of incessant thinking. When relieved of this thinking, peace can come. Like it says in the St. Francis prayer, you become a channel of the peace, an instrument of a state that exists and wants to be expressed but is blocked by the kinks in the pipe, typically angst, fear, pride, whatever. Interestingly, Ganesh, the elephant-headed Hindu deity, is known as the remover of obstacles. When I first heard that, I thought it meant obstacles like a boss who irritates you or a boyfriend of a girl you like. Now I think it means the obstacles within the self that prevent you from being in harmony with God. If you can be free from pride, self-pity, self-centeredness, selfishness, jealousy, envy, intolerance, impatience, greed, gluttony, lust, sloth, arrogance and dishonesty, then there is a state of serenity and connectedness within. Like Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is within, which seems, once and for all, to bust wide open the daft afterlife view of heaven as some kind of Lando Calrissian cloud kingdom that you can get into like Alton Towers if you acquire enough good boy tokens. Kundalini, in my view, is more boldly transcendent, more euphoric than other yoga that I've done, so I obviously got totally addicted to it and started doing it all the time. The experience wasn't entirely free from ego either, as I was quite prolific in my physical engagement with female members of the class and eventually nominated myself as leader and took over the entire shebang like Hitler in a sari. In my hands, or more importantly my head, even a tranquil canvas like a yoga class can end up spattered with the neon splurge of my avaricious ego. The need for personal vigilance is well demonstrated by my conduct around the Kundalini yoga experience. I have no doubt that Kundalini yoga as a technology for improving consciousness is valid, and that doing it in communities is beneficial. But there is no context in which my ego, if not fastidiously monitored, won't run amok. It is extremely difficult to put aside a lifetime's conditioning. The only way I can stay drug-free is one day at a time, with vigilance, humility and support. My tendency is still, after 11 years, to drift towards oblivion. My appetite for attention, too, can only be positively directed with great care. Look out your window, turn on your TV, see which values are being promoted, which aspects of humanity are being celebrated. The alarm bells of fear and desire are everywhere. These powerful primal tools designed to aid survival in a world unrecognizable to modern civilized humans are relentlessly jangled. A facet of our unevolved nature comparable to that which still craves sugar and fat, a relic from the days when it was scarce, is being pricked and jabbed and buzzed every time we see a billboard bikini or a Coca-Cola floozy. Our saber-toothed terrors and mammoth anxieties are being dragged up and strung out by shrill transmission about immigrants, junkies, pit bulls and cancer. Once I sat in that Kundalini class in white robes, cross-legged, with pan-piped serenity caressing the congregation as we meditated as one, and all I was really thinking about was if I should buy a gun. I was in America, after all, and you are allowed a gun. Have you ever held a 38 Glock? It feels so cool in your hand. Even the word makes you feel tough. Glock. Tupac had one. Eminem loves them.
I want one. Never mind all this hippy-dippy yin-yang Ramadan green juice bullshit. I want a gat like Tupac. Of course I think things like that. The messages that are broadcast on that frequency move fast and stick hard. Look at the state of the world. I didn't buy one, though. My mum had to remind me that I'm a peace-loving lad and that if I had a gun in the house, the person most at risk would be me. The Kundalini techniques worked. They advanced my mind. They tuned me in. How much more powerful these techniques would be if supported by a culture of spiritual evolution, not one of self-fortification. Perhaps if my religious education had constituted more than glum Calvinist witterings and brass rubbings of church doors, I'd be better equipped in the midst of the numinous howl in the Kensal Green Church Hall. Here, a sentiment like, "Thine is the kingdom, the power and the glory," is not a bureaucratic proposal stenciled onto a municipal sign. No diving, no heavy petting, glory in the blazing light of the Lord, but a dance, a stomp, a chant. I've been hunched at the back for a little while now, a static Rodin of disingenuous genuflection, when I think, would it really matter if I got taken to the front? I'm the only member of the congregation, aside from the little girl, who has as yet been spared the backslapping, prodding and spinning that occurs when you're summoned to the front. I consider leaving. It'd be easy enough. Just a nod to the tweeny administrator and then a purposeful sidle. But then I think, how bad can it be? I'll just be hauled up the front before this spellbound assembly. I mean, it might be embarrassing, but no one ever died of embarrassment, even if shame is the number one cause of suicide. These paddocks we inhabit, these mind-made manacles that hold us back from the exhilarating naked chase of freedom, I should stay to prove to myself, other me, negative, fearful me, that we can do it, me and him, the pair of us, both me's, confident, strident, connected me, and fearful, clenched, small-town, small-minded me, together. I decide to stay, knowing too that anecdotes are the product of decisions like these. And as I kneel in negotiation with aspects of myself, along comes Carlton. He seems slightly self-conscious too, like he's not too enraptured to notice that I'm conflicted. He gives me a, "Shall we do this?" nod, and I give him a, "We shall," one back. On the short walk to the front, past the others, either bowing or kneeling or whirling or howling, I feel glad that my life is this way, so full of jarring experience. Sometimes you feel that life is full and beautiful, all these worlds, all these people, all these experiences, all this wonder. You never know when you will encounter magic. Some solitary moment in a park can suddenly burst open with a spray of preschool children in high-vis vests hand in hand. Maybe the teacher will ask you for directions and the children will look at you curious and open and you'll see that they are perfect. In the half-morning, half-grey glint, the cobwebs on bushes are gleaming with such radiant insistence you can feel the playful unknown beckoning. Behind impassive stares in booths, behind the indifferent gum chew, behind the car horns, there is a connection. Now I'm up the front and tall bloke long suit is still sea-kyling, women are still jiggling and beseeching. There is an unspoken acknowledgement that I'm an interloper, that I am unlike everybody else there, neither Eritrean nor Ethiopian, and that there is a risk, therefore, that I am there to mock or judge or disrupt, and I'm capable of all those things. The three main men, Bellamy, Orange Shirt and Carlton, close in, and it's a bit like a scene from The Lion King, you know, one of the scary bits. Then there are hands on me and a kind of revolving. It's a bit like being the blindfolded one in Pin the Tail on the Donkey. I don't know about you, but I'm a bit too self-conscious, well, selves-conscious, because there's more than one of me in here, to just leap into full-force abandonment. I've got a too finely attuned sense of humour. I'm too English to blaze out onto a dance floor or altar and start flinging my limbs around. The second voice, the fearful me, is not going to stand for that. He's in there, perched on an ottoman, waiting for me to relax. And then, with an intonation like Terry Thomas, "What on earth do you think you're doing? I suggest you sit back down." It's hard to commit or join in with him in there. Bellamy has clearly overcome any doubt he has in his self, if not in me, as he is now insistently inquiring, "Do you accept Jesus Christ?" He says it in English, so he definitely knows I'm not Eritrean. The jig is up. "Do you accept Jesus Christ?" he says again, like Jesus is a credit card and I am an unhelpful waiter. The conditions of the inquiry do not suggest that there is time for me to go into my honest answer, Yes, but there are some caveats. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, sent to earth to redeem us all. Jesus Christ, the Jewish nationalist radical. Jesus Christ, the metaphor for the divine within the corporeal. Jesus Christ, the human being superimposed, literally placed on the cross, the pagan geometric emblem that represents on the vertical plane the relationship between the earthly and the divine, and on the other horizontal plane the lateral relationships between individual humans. Christ as the end of paganism, the beginning of individualism, of idolatry, of the acceptance that some humans are more equal than others. Christ as a reminder that we must all constantly die and be born again, moment to moment, to live forever in the now. As Wittgenstein said, if eternity is taken not to be an infinite temporal duration but the quality of timelessness, then are we not all eternal if we live in the present? Christ as the symbol that the flesh human, that the carnal human ape has expired, and we can achieve no more until we transcend, until we ascend into new conscious realms and manifest the divine on earth as it is in heaven. Do you accept Jesus Christ? He says again, and this time gives me a bit of a prod, which he tries to pass off as shamanic, but I think is actually frustration. The answer, as I've outlined above, is conditionally yes. The most expedient answer is a totally unconditional yes. So that's the answer I give. Yes. Bellamy wants more. Demon out! He hollers and grabs at my gut in a manner that in any, literally any other context would be totally unacceptable. I mean, he grabs a handful of my belly. I'm not fat, so he's probably got some actual intestine and all. Then he sort of twists it like an apple stalk. I'm torn between the respectful compliance required of a tourist, shock, and also curiosity, as the place he grabs is where, if you asked me to point, I would consistently locate my anxiety. Anxiety that is exacerbated by being grabbed in the guts in a church hall in Kensal Green. When, at the umpteenth time of asking, I admit in a voice as loud as I can muster that yes, I do accept Jesus, everyone cheers. They are well chuffed that I accept Jesus. I then shuffle back and take a seat, now less self-conscious and a little more entitled. When the worship is at its peak, its wild, emphatic, orgiastic, juddering, shrieking, spasming peak, I wonder how will they ever climb down from this summit of selflessness? How will this animalistic, holy frenzy segue into people shaking hands and stacking chairs? At some Anglican sermon in Surrey, the file down the aisle, handshake, smile ending is the energetic climax of the proceedings. After a polite rendition of Jerusalem, in which Blake was apparently being sarcastic, or All Things Bright and Beautiful, which Stuart Lee breaks down beautifully, there isn't a moment of post-coital awkwardness where everyone thinks, fuck me, we really let ourselves go there. The hymns, the prayers, the sermon and the departure never interrupt the frequency of neat obedience. That is, of course, the problem. I mean, what's the point? If there is some omnipotent force behind all phenomena and we are trying to access it through our consciousness, then surely that can't be done without breaking a sweat or ruffling some hair. The lady I sit next to explains that the language is Amharic, that this is a community of Ethiopian and Eritrean people, that they are Christian. I'm invited to stand up and introduce myself from the pulpit. Before I stand to speak, though, it is announced by the pastor that I am famous. Another bloke, it transpires, is also there for the first time and feels compelled to admit apologetically that he isn't famous, which makes me feel a bit sad. The problem I anticipated of re-entering a more normal tone of social interaction does not manifest. No one seems remotely bothered. I suppose to them it's normal, and their ritual can withstand various pitches. A few people want photos or whatever, the little girl, Carlton, tall bloke, who is called Julian and is, when he switches from Amharic to English, actually bloody charming. As I leave, I feel the value of shared ritual, community, common unity, and a forum in which to express energy and sensations that don't have any safe context in secular society. We are paying a price for that. Where do we see this sense of abandon? Where do we participate in mass rituals of unity and transcendence? Where is it safe to put aside ego and self-consciousness? Anfield, Old Trafford, Upton Park? Here in these aluminium colosseums there is licensed event. For me, football is fused with fear and manhood and violence, but also with craving, belonging and hope. It usually takes until about half time before I'm even half relaxed. At first I'm self-conscious, too aware of myself and my boundaries, real and imagined, to submerge. by staring into the lawn portal, by yielding to the rhythm of the chant, the drama of the game, the acceptance of the temporary order of the rules and the end-to-end chaos within it, I become hypnotised. Where are we relieved from the bean-counting, box-ticking, horizonless, mute horror of our technological gulags? Leicester Town Centre, midnight, midwinter, drink some cider, get insider, 2-for-1, in the sun, England, do a gram, drop a pill, download an app, eat some crap, get a slap, mind the gap, do a line, Instagram, little grope in a cab. Chapter 6. Tiny Problems in Infinite Space. When I still used, I was once working in Ibiza, hedonism capital of the 90s and turn of the millennium. People swayed in sweaty swathes and stayed pilled up for days. I couldn't participate because I was too shy or broken, caught on some taut barbed wire in my mind. Me and my mate Matt, high one night, lost ourselves, found ourselves in a wood and pretended to be animals. It was just us, and we prowled and circled around. We locked eyes and growled and danced. Let's pretend we're animals was forgotten, and we were animals. We are animals. We are free animals with a divine spark. We're not in a farm or a zoo or a theme park. We're free. We've forgotten that we're free. There's so much to do, so much on TV, that we've forgotten that we're free. No rituals or myths that remind us that we have a shared destiny and shared needs, even if our shared destiny is death and our shared need is life. We have downloaded a program with a virus in it. We've been boxed off and ripped off. Terence McKenna, the philosopher shaman fella, said the all-encompassing stance of conventional science is, give us one free miracle and we'll explain the rest. That one miracle is the spontaneous appearance of all matter, energy, phenomena, consciousness and rules in a single instant, which was preceded by and is surrounded by nothingness. This is the theory of the Big Bang. My belief is that we do not currently operate on a frequency of consciousness that is capable of interpreting the information required to understand the great mystery. I believe that the mechanical model for understanding nature is a metaphor that science has got stuck on. This prevailing idea that humans are machines, biological robots with computer-like brains. This belief will, to the advanced species that we are evolving into, seem as absurd as the flat earth theories that we scoff at now. Those flat earth folk weren't just pretending they thought the earth was flat. They genuinely believed it. They looked down at the flat ground and its flat appearance and took that as empirical evidence of its flatness. They could not conceive of another way of seeing it. Left to me, the flat earth theory would still be dominant. I've never been to space and seen the earth's curvature. I've seen pictures of the spherical earth placed in the context of our solar system or spinning like a misty marble in the blackness. But I can't say for sure what it looks like from space because I'm standing on it. It took a new emergent strain of understanding that challenged the dogma of the time to recontextualise the way we see our planet. The time we live in now is similar because of the mechanistic reductive dogma of scientism. The belief that everything in the world can be explained using the scientific method is about to be similarly overthrown. There are just too many questions, unanswered and unanswerable. Consciousness, the consciousness that is now experiencing these words, has no explanation in science. Scientists believe that matter has no consciousness, and that consciousness comes from matter. 70% of the universe is made from dark matter, although they don't know what that is, what it does, or anything, just that it's there. Science requires faith the way religion does. Science requires acceptance of metaphor, just the way religion does. Does science cause wars the way religion does, you might ask? I would say those conflicts are actually about territory, either ideological or physical, and that those ideas are materialistic in the same way science is, and the weapons with which those wars are fought, who creates those? I'm not condemning the process of gathering and testing information to advance our understanding of our environment. That's plainly a useful human tool. What I query is this pragmatic system of research being allowed to invade territories for which it was not designed to cater. An astronomer once explained to me that the galaxy we live in, the Milky Way, is vast, too vast to be understood without metaphor, so he gave me one. He said, if you picture the Milky Way as being the size of mainland Europe, our solar system, that's Mars, Venus, Saturn, us, here on Earth, you remember from school, in a Milky Way the size of Europe, our solar system would fit inside a single teacup somewhere in Belgium. He paused for my amazement, which I duly offered. But really, what can you say? Ooh, a teacup. Blimey, Belgium. Core makes you think, doesn't it? Then he added, clearly sensing I was at a bit of a loss for words, having just been reduced to a dot on a speck in a teacup in a continent. Russell, there are 400 million known galaxies in our universe. I'd been looking through a telescope at Jupiter, or what we call Jupiter. It can't possibly know that it's called that any more than a newborn baby can know whether it's a Christian or a Muslim. Jupiter is orbited by four moons. What struck me as I looked at Jupiter, 370 million miles away in perfect suspension with the moons visibly revolving, was not the might of this planet which the Romans took to be the king of their gods, but its elegant fragility. The awe. Whatever you are doing, Jupiter and its moons are up there, silent or roaring, observing or ignoring, connected through time and light and an unbreakable chain of subatomic threads. We receive data through five portals, five windows. The house of human consciousness has but five windows. Do you imagine that we will ever perceive all through these five windows? Do you imagine that that which is most important can ever be seen? How do you describe the most important things that have ever happened to you? The moment you knew you loved her? Can you assemble that magnetic pull with the Lego of light and language? The moment you heard he died? Can you define it, calcify it, crystallize it, make it live again? Or is it at best a kind of taxidermy that language can provide? A stuffed dead effigy with cold unseeing eyes. And Jupiter revolves. And the moon watches. The moon you saw as a child. The moon that hung in the sky when Christ was crucified. The crescent moon like a tear in heaven as the prophet heard Allah. All human history, every poem, every lie, all here on this sphere. What am I? A small creature measuring seven spans of my own hand. I am enclosed in a pot-like universe composed of material nature, the total material energy, force, ego, ether, air, water and earth. And what is your glory? Unlimited universes pass through the pores of your body just as particles of dust pass through the openings of a screened window. Bhagavata Purana 10.14.11. It is perhaps because of passages like the one above that Joseph Campbell favoured Hindu and pre-Hindu mythology as an efficient tool to convey important stories. Clearly this passage is poetic, philosophical and attempting to explain a mystery which has now been colonised by materialistic thinking. I also wonder whether seven hand spans is a normal height. I've been trying to measure myself using this technique, but I'm always hijacked at the groin. The American poet and feminist Muriel Rakiza said, "The universe is not made of atoms, it's made of stories." I suppose what that implies is that atoms are themselves a metaphor, a symbol, a tool for telling a story. They have already been surpassed in the spiralling journey down into the microcosmic by quarks. What mayhem too lives in that tiny world where electrons appear simultaneously in the same place, not different electrons, the same electron, where electrons will behave as either particles or waves depending on whether or not they're being observed. I don't want to seem ungrateful to science. Science, after all, is what's provided me with this story, but now is the time to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. The ideological battle that needed to be fought against repressive orthodoxy, bigoted institutions and repressive religions can now be won. For it not to be futile, we must overcome similar dogma in the field of science. A person experiences life as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. Our task must be to free ourselves from this self-imposed prison and through compassion to find the reality of oneness. Albert Einstein. The bedheaded genius was onto something. We need to focus on relevant truths, the truths that will aid our survival. Not the temporary truth that we are dislocated, mechanical blobs motivated by our cocks and our guts. We must promote the pertinent truths, the way that bigoted Republicans have Frankensteined the perfect Christ for their cause. Their Jesus has pulled off one miracle further to those documented by becoming some sort of gun-toting, homophobic, Rasputin-up Donald Trump. Legal asterisk. The idealised Christ of the right would be like Donald Trump, but with these additional qualities. The adjectives indicate that the qualities are an enhancement, exaggeration, or supplement to Donald as is. That's why I didn't just write Donald Trump without adjectives. So I'm not saying Donald Trump is comparable to the Russian mystic Rasputin, who incidentally I adore, or I am legally obliged to say homophobic. Bible Jesus, who, let's face it, has probably been through several prejudicial edits to reach the King James whitewashed version, is still a considerable theological distance from the vicious prick that them lot are so into. For a kickoff, he don't give a toss about sex or pushing misogyny or homophobia. He, in fact, seems much more interested in the corruptive power of money. Give to the poor and receive treasure in heaven. Jesus is pretty committed to sharing. Also, as we know, it's the moneylenders that Jesus kicks out of the temple. This is my father's house and you have turned it into a den of thieves. It's the only time Jesus got really wound up. Even when he was being unjustly nailed to a cross, he stayed mellow. When the crowd, given the chance to pardon one of the convicts up for crucifixion, chose Barabbas, a known crook, Jesus took it on the chin. The only time he ever let himself go and knocked over tables was when the financial industry was prioritised over normal people. It wasn't the gays he kicked out of the temple. This is my father's house and you've turned it into a gay bar. The gays were fine. Jesus had no policy on sex. I met some members of the Westboro Baptist Church once and they were all right. It was like they knew they were being silly. I had them on a chat show I was doing in America. I felt like I could have gone, come on, lads. You don't really believe that God hates fags, do you? And they'd have gone, oh, of course not. Don't be deaf. We're just having a bit of fun. The promotion of homophobia to priority status on the Lord's behalf takes some doing. The scriptural evidence that he gave a toss is scant. It seems to me that a lot of people are using religious arguments to advance their own prejudices. I don't think these preachers of hate and mad mullahs and whatnot were one day reading their doctrine of choice in a sanguine mood, aglow with joy and tolerance, when they happened upon a verse of bigoted scripture. Bloody hell, I was inclined to quite like the gays, my cousin's one, but look, here in Leviticus, it quite clearly states, don't lie down with another man. Well, that's that. Clearly, prejudice is a permutation of some psychological fear, later mandated by convenient evidence from the book. If God appeared tomorrow and said he'd changed his mind, would homophobia disappear? You'd think if God was that bothered about homosexuality, he'd have mentioned it in his top 10 do's and don'ts, the Ten Commandments. It's not in there. From a biblical perspective, homosexuality is not considered as transgressive as the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet thy neighbour's oxen. If he considered it that important, he could have added a commandment. I mean, he is God. He doesn't have to stick to decimal neatness. He could just go, oh yeah, number 11 is don't be gay. Or let the whole oxen thing fall by the wayside. From a balanced reading of the Ten Commandments, we can only assume that God would prefer you to have gay sex than to covet your neighbour's oxen. If you'd had a terrible day at work and had to do some sinning just to unwind, the commandments are clear about which sin is considered more unholy. God, I've had a terrible day at work. I've got to let off some steam. Either I'm going to have sex with Terry or I'm going to covet my neighbour's oxen. What? No, you mustn't do that. You better go hang out with Terry. Thank you, Lord. I'm going to slide my erect penis right up Terry's anus. Fair enough, son. I don't really have a policy on that. I will ask, though, that you don't look over next door's fence at them grazing oxen. Then, imagine in your mind, what would it be like if those oxen were my oxen? Don't do that, will you? I won't. I'm going to empty myself into Terry, then put my mouth over his... Okay. Do what you've got to do. Just remember, those are not your oxen. Anyone who claims to be operating on a model designed to fulfil the will of Jesus or Allah or Krishna or anyone who isn't first and foremost dedicated to the union of all humankind and service of the needy is on a massive blag. Whether that's hillbilly situationists like the WBC, self-serving neoliberalists or Taliban gangsters. Any American politician who says they're Christian must have as their uppermost priority the removal of the moneylenders from the temple, the undue, corrupt and disgusting influence of the financial industry on public life. Any British politician like Prime Minister David Cameron who claims to be a Christian, which means to practice the teachings of Jesus Christ, has to, like Jesus, heal the sick, not, like a cunt, sell off the NHS. Which bit of Christianity do you believe in? Oh, I'd have to say the bit where you turn up at a church in a suit at Christmas or Easter and stand around looking a bit solemn. Yeah, that's clearly what he was driving at. The only meaningful interpretation of any religious teaching is to honour the divine within ourselves and love the divine in one another, to disavow the individualistic, materialistic evangelism of our age and serve that which transcends these lowly impulses. Any version of any theology that manifests as dazzling costumes and palaces for the bloke at the front is bollocks. Most religion is wrapped around the bellicose enforcement of a metaphor, but that doesn't mean we should dismiss the mystery. Science has donned the haughty robes of the pedagogues it displaced, but we can be grateful for the new lexicon and the contemporary understanding of ancient truths. When I was an atheist, it was because I rejected authority, and why not reject the supreme authority of God, particularly that boring fucker on Songs of Praise? I could reject him with the unsentimental dispatch of a clipped toenail. When I got clean from drugs and alcohol, I saw that the way I'd always seen the world was limited. It will always be limited. By yielding authority to a benign power, I found a key to transcend previous limitations, modest limitations like being unable to survive without the use of drugs and alcohol. Until the time when I got clean, I'd had little experience of loving powerful authority. Authority had only been corrupt or inefficient in my experience. My nan, who I never much loved, I had a 50% success rate with nans, loved one was cool about the other, and I were once ambulating down an Essex street. I believe it was Brentwood, now famed as the setting for the opera to idiocy that is The Only Way is Essex. My indifference to this nan need not have been her fault. She may simply have been an outer emblem for my inner discomfort. How did it feel in there to you when you were a child in the aquarium of your head? I was lonely in mine as the world swam by in immaculately choreographed schools like an inaccessible gang of Nemos. I was only really at ease with my mum and animals, and I treated them pretty badly. If you feel how I felt, I have been taught a few techniques that might help you. Here's one for a kickoff. You have to forgive everyone for everything. You can't cling on to any blame that you may be using to make sense of the story of your life. Even me, with my story of one nan that I love and another that I don't, that story is being used to maintain a certain perspective of mine, a perspective that justifies the way I am. And by justifying the way I am, I ensure that I stay the same. I'm no longer interested in staying the same. I'm interested in revolution. That means I have to go back and change the story of my childhood. You might think of yourself as some kind of umpire of veracity and righteousness. You can't change the truth. You can't forgive people who've done wrong. What helped me to overcome those outmoded concepts was the understanding that there is no such thing as right or wrong, merely an interrelated system of beliefs. I was taught that my reality, including the whole concept of a self, is a construct and that I can alter it if it isn't conducive to my well-being. This perhaps undeservedly unloved nan and I were walking along, likely only flung together as my mum was away in hospital, and she was explaining to me her religious beliefs. I now know that these beliefs were typical Protestant doctrine and that she was a relatively typical woman of her time and background. I recently researched my family tree and quite quickly labels of class are smudged into nonsense. For a couple of generations back, it's all very proletariat in every direction. Bethnal Green bottle makers and jobs that belong in Dickens. But with the generational doubling that occurs before too long, it's a muddle of all manner of colliding types. Scullery maids and sculptors, officers and gentlemen. There's no clear upstairs downstairs as our ancestors were all resolutely fucking each other on the landing. The filthy dead perverts. Then, of course, through the umbilical link, we all tumble backwards down the spiralling DNA staircase to one common ancestor in Africa, and before that, some bunch of curious monkeys. Down and down we go, unto the sea, unto the dust, the single cellular dust. What impulse drove one cell to become two? What yearning pulled the fish onto the land? What caused apes to walk upright? Some invisible magnetic pull. Is there a difference between attraction and intention? Where is evolution taking us? The early Christians favoured the fish as the symbol of their burgeoning cult, the cross perhaps still regarded as being too recent to be apt. The fish symbol that they deployed was appropriated, in fact, from a pre-existing pagan order that believed an oceanic goddess had given birth to humanity. Isn't that just a different way of saying we came from the sea? Water, too, in emblems both inner and outer, in the world of dreams, in the world of myth, symbolises the unconscious. Dreams are private myths, myths are public dreams, said old Joe Campbell. I'm getting overly familiar now as I ransack his legacy. The unconscious, the aspect of ourselves we by definition do not know, is difficult to describe. Carl Jung believed that we had a collective unconscious, that we're all sharing it like a bunch of unwitting communists. Jung, the mystical Sundance kid to Sigmund Freud's staunch Butch Cassidy, observed that common motifs cropped up in people's dreams and that there was a corollary to symbols and even structure that could be found in various folk tales and myths. So Jung offered up the idea that consciousness could exist outside the mind and that we all have access to it. This is implicit too in Campbell's work in his global studies of the stories humans tell each other to make sense of the world. He found astonishing consistencies in the formula. Folk in Africa, Iceland, Nairobi and Wisconsin are all telling each other similar stories. How the fuck is that happening if we're a bunch of dislocated individuals living in a bunch of dislocated tribes? A way of understanding it might be that the unconscious mind is up to all sorts of stuff all day long that I'm not taking responsibility for. Blinking, peristalsis, digestion, fighting bacteria, fashioning perfect little stools that could be sold at a village fete with a flag stuck in them saying Russell's unconscious mind made this. Everybody's anatomical unconscious is doing more or less the same thing unless they are deficient or mutated. Someone said, thinking that you're in charge of your totality of being with all its complex facilities is like a stowaway on an ocean steamliner thinking he's the captain of the ship. Conventional, mechanical, materialistic science will tell you that that's because there's proteins stored in the genes telling them to do that. This isn't strictly true, though. If you took an arm and a leg and ground them into a powder, and I'm not suggesting you do, it'd likely land you in the clink, you would discover that there is no particular genetic data that determines that a leg must be a leg and an arm an arm. There is some untraceable component that does that defining work. Some people think that there is a magnetic memory outside of the material that guides the direction of the manifestation. Once you accept the concept of data being held beyond the physical, new worlds open up. In a way, if my unconscious mind and yours are doing the same job, more or less, of generating cells and movements and procedures, the imposition of anatomic individualization is redundant. We're all doing the same thing, dreaming the same dream, in the words of Belinda Carlisle, who also said, heaven is a place on earth, by which she might have meant that the concept of a divine realm is not in the hereafter, but present now as a realm of being achieved when we look beyond our material parameters and individualistic desires. I'm going to listen to that track again. In fact, the whole album warrants further scrutiny in the light of these revelations. Again, I'm not advocating the abandonment of science like a modern-day Ned Ludd, a concept he would have especially hated, smashing up the microscopes and telescopes and particle accelerators, merely that we accept that we have allowed it to stray beyond its rightful dominion. When you get Richard Dawkins yapping menopausally at some poor hamstrung old archbishop while we dismantle our environment due to the materialistic, pessimistic principle that the atheistic tyranny of the day is tacitly sponsoring, it's time to look for a new story. If all there is only that which we can prove, then we live as disconnected, condemned animals. We need faith now more than ever, because our ideologies are obscuring the fact that we have more important things in common than in conflict. My nan walks purposefully with me at her side.
We are definitely not flaneurs, who wandered with no specific intent, mostly through the Parisian streets of a century ago, knowing that abundant wonder will be uncovered if you trust the day to be glorious.
Of course, they were bowling about in Paris, likely off their nuts on absinthe, not shuffling up Brentwood High Street in Clark's sandals with a fistful of dolly mixtures and a nan they don't much like because the narrative of themselves they've constructed requires adversity.
I believe in God, says my nan, in a way that makes the idea of an omnipotent, unifying frequency of energy manifesting matter from pure consciousness sound like a chore, an unnecessary chore at that, like cleaning under the fridge.
I tell her, plucky little seven-year-old that I was, that I don't. This pisses her off. Her faith in God is not robust enough to withstand the casual blasphemy of an agnostic tot. Who do you think made the world, then?
I remember her demanding as fiercely as Jeremy Paxman would later insist I provide an instant global infrastructure for a post-revolutionary utopia.
Builders, I said, thinking on my feet.
This flummoxed her and put her in a bad mood for the rest of the walk.
If she'd hit back with, what about construction at a planetary or galactic level, she'd have had me on the ropes. At that age, I wouldn't have been able to riposte with an advanced species of extraterrestrials who we've been mistakenly ascribing divine attributes to due to our own technological limitations, or a spontaneous cosmic combustion that contained at its genesis the code for all subsequent astronomical, chemical and biological evolution. I probably would have just cried. Anyway, I'm supposed to be explaining the power of forgiveness, not gloating about a conflict in the early 80s in which I fared well against an old lady. Since getting clean from drugs and alcohol, I've been taught that I played a part in the manufacture of all the negative beliefs and experiences from my past, and I certainly play a part in their maintenance. I now look at my nan in another way. As a human being, just like me, trying to cope with her own flaws and challenges, fearful of what would become of her sick daughter, confused by the grandchild born of a match that she was adverse to, alone and approaching the end of her life with regret and lacking a functioning system of guidance and comfort, trying her best, taking on the responsibility of an unusual little boy with glib, atheistic tendencies, she still behaved dutifully. Perhaps this very conversation sparked in me the spirit of metaphysical inquiry that has led to the faith in God I now have. Chapter 7. A Few Rotten Apples. Whilst I write this, Britain, the concept of a country I live in, as the result of a European election, has advanced this odd political outfit called UKIP. It's 6 months since I did the interview with Jeremy Paxman that inspired this book, and British media today is awash with half-hearted condemnations of my observation that voting is pointless and my admission that I have never voted. My assertion that other people oughtn't vote either was born of the same instinctive rejection of the mantle of appointed social prefect that prevents me from telling teenagers to just say no to drugs. I cannot confine my patronage to the circuitry of their minuscule wisdom.
People died so you'd have the right to vote.
No, they didn't. They died for freedom. In the case where freedom was explicitly attached to the symbol of democratic rights, like female suffrage, I don't imagine they'd have been so willing if they'd known how tokenistic voting was to become. Note, too, these martyrs did not achieve their ends by participating in a hollow, predefined ritual, the infertile dry hump of gestural democracy. They did it by direct action. Emily Davison, the hero of women's suffrage, hurled herself in front of the king's horses. She defied the tyranny that oppressed her and broke the boundaries that contained her. I imagine, too, that this woman would have had the rebellious perspicacity to understand that the system she was opposing would adjust to incorporate the female vote and deftly render it irrelevant. This woman, who left her job as a teacher to dedicate her life to activism, was imprisoned 9 times. She used methods as severe and diverse as arson and hunger striking to protest, and at the time of her death would have been regarded as a terrorist. Today her legacy has been so thoroughly douched that an anodyne brass plaque can be placed in the halls of Westminster, a trite, bland tribute to her heroism. Emily Davison would not be urging the disempowered people of today to vote. She'd be urging them to riot. Has the once gleaming sword of democracy, this weapon of power for the masses, been so blunted that it is now seen merely as a quilted draft excluder upon which extremists might stumble? To
to stop UKIP getting more seats in Thurrock Council or in Brussels. This is democracy's endgame. It's like using Excalibur to put a new plug on a toaster. It hadn't occurred to me, coming from where I'm from, that people considered parliamentary politics as anything other than a distraction. I only mentioned not voting in my New Statesman article that led to the Paxman furore because I was informed it was noteworthy. For me, it's standard. I don't feel responsible for telling kids not to vote. I feel like I deserve a Blue Peter badge for not telling them to riot, for not telling them that they are entitled to destroy the cathedrals of tyranny erected to mock them in the heart of their community, that they should rise up and destroy the system that imprisons them, ignores them, condemns and maligns them by any means necessary. I might also note that I think it's unlikely that people aren't voting because